and I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education. I'm very proud to be a part of this Tuesday evening lecture series. I think most of you who are here are familiar with the series, but if you're not, I invite you to go online and look at the upcoming lectures. For example, next week, Nicola Vassell, who is a young curator, art writer, and a director at Deitch Projects, who is receiving a great deal of attention. Currently, specifically for exhibitions like Subtraction, which featured the paintings of young artists, including, I just wanted to mention, make these connections, Rosin Crowe. And Rosin Crowe will be the next focus show artist, and she will also be one of the Tuesday evening speakers on March 31st. So it'll be kind of nice to hear from Nicola and her ideas on abstract painting in today's context. The title of her presentation for Tuesday evening, in fact, is Dark Art, A New Conversation with Abstraction. She has a really interesting take on how abstraction is relevant with a new generation. So I invite you back next week, and I encourage you to invite the people you care about to be here. Tonight, we are fortunate to have Gavin Morrison, an enormously well-read, thoughtful, innovative, and witty art writer and curator. Gavin received an MA in mental philosophy at the University of Edinburgh, followed by postgraduate residency with the CORE program at the Glassell School, part of the MFA in Houston that I think some of you may be familiar with. It's quite an honor to be a part of that program. He was part of the writing program there. He is also a director of Atopia Projects, which is a curatorial and publishing initiative. And on the website, it's described as interested in generating projects that reorient the integrity, limitations, and potential of existing systems of cultural production. Some of the recent projects, I was going to give you that website. I knew there was something that I wanted to alert you to. I encourage you to go to Atopia's website, which is atopiaprojects.org, and look into some of the things. Some of the projects you'll find there include the 2008 exhibition Lifting and its accompanying publication, a very interesting exhibition that is a traveling exhibition that actually morphs to some extent with each of the different venues, changing artists, and all of that's documented in the publication. Also, the publication Shotgun Wedding, which was done in 2007, and then Houston, Meese, Johnston, which was also published in 2007. Gavin is also a freelance writer, having most recently co-authored the book The Slender Margin with Kiyoshi Akatsu, thank you, and Andrew Sneeden, and having edited the book The Melancholy Thistle and Other Works. And currently, in his role as curator of the Fort Worth Contemporary Arts at TCU, Gavin is developing an ever-growing art audience, many of whom are in this audience tonight, by bringing provocative exhibitions such as the aforementioned Lifting, Electioneering, Warhol and the Shared Subject, and now on view, Margaret H. Blondahl and Lars Laumann to the DFW Metroplex. Gavin is an asset to this community, and I'm quite grateful that he was willing to contribute to the Tuesday evening lecture series with the presentation of a humorous yet brilliant idea that he has been batting around for some time now concerning the character and myths of Texas and the art world, bringing the two together in a hypothetical proposal of a Texas pavilion for the 2011 Venice Biennale. And tonight's lecture titled Cowboys on the Lido. And before we all welcome Gavin, I meant to mention that on Saturday, in conjunction with the exhibition Margaret H. Blondahl and Lars Laumann, there will be a panel including Gavin, Noah Simblist, who's in the audience tonight and has previously done a Tuesday evening lecture, some of you may remember, and Richard Patterson, who actually has also done a Tuesday evening lecture in the past. So I think that should be quite lively, and I invite you to that on Saturday at the TCU's space, the Fort Worth Contemporary. And with that, I think we'll turn it over to Gavin. Please join me in welcoming Gavin Morrison.
Thanks for that. It was almost unbelievable, that introduction. I think maybe I should preface this by saying that Terry was implicated in the generation of this idea in a bus stop in Aix-en-Provence. So as much as you can hold me to blame, Terry is also liable to some extent. This idea of cowboys on the Lido, it's going up here, sorry. Scottish. It's a subtle but important... Oh, Jesus.
John,
is that me doing that? Oh, here he comes, racing.
Let's check your connection at the laptop.
Okay. Thank you, John. That was working perfectly before. the Cowboys and the Lido is, I suppose it's kind of like an opening salvo in a kind of an actual proposal or purpose. Although it's trying to be slightly humorous and good-natured, I also wanted to talk about the real possibility of realising a pavilion in 2011. It seems that the date is auspicious in as much as it will also be the 175th anniversary of the founding of the Republic of Texas. But also, a couple of years seems just about enough time to pull the thing together, get it beyond being a pipe dream. So although my thoughts are kind of streaked with a sort of whimsical approach, I think that I want this talk to be part of a series of combined efforts to sort of engage a public consultation, seeing what Texans actually think of the idea. As somebody's already noticed, I'm not from these parts. Yes, I'm Scottish, and maybe that's part of the reason why this idea occurred to me, but more of that later. So the other thing that I should preface this with is that I'm also really not going to show any art from Texas, which kind of seems somewhat paradoxical, but hopefully will make some kind of sense as we go through. I really want to kind of look at what a strange beast Venice is, both within the art world and beyond, and the way in which art is used throughout the world as a form of cultural capital, used to propagate ideas of nationhood and cultural identity, and that these functions kind of often have other political agendas. This is an image of Jim Lambie's installation at the 2005 Venice Biennale. And Venice is, as you see here, it's a very old and strange city. When I started thinking about this presentation, I turn to a couple of literary references to think about how to talk about Venice. One of the first was Italo Calvino's book Invisible Cities, which is a novel where Marco Polo is describing to Kublai Khan the various improbable and outlandish cities that he's seen on his journeys. However, it transpires through the novel that what he's actually describing is the various and multifaceted nature of Venice itself. It's Venice is that city that is everything and nothing. It's kind of part apparition, part folly. The sinking city on the Adriatic and its cultural and architectural intertwined history kind of is so involved and heavy within the experience of the city that you sometimes feel you can never get beyond it. The other source that I fell into or started thinking about was Thomas Mann's novel Death in Venice. The story's central character, Gustav von Aschenbach, is headed to Venice as a respite from his work. And on his way there, I'll just read a short extract. He's on a ferry amongst a group of raucous youths, and one of whom catches his eye, and he writes about this character. He wore a light yellow summer suit of extravagant cut, scarlet necktie and a rakishly tilted Panama hat, and was the most conspicuous of them all of the group that he was in his shrill hilarity. But as soon as Aschenbach took a closer look at him, he realised with a kind of horror that the man's youth was false. He was old, there was no mistaking it. There were wrinkles round his eyes and mouth. His cheeks, faint carmine, was rouge. The brown hair under his straw hat with his coloured ribbon was a wig. His neck was flaccid and scrawny. His small stuck-on moustache and little imperial on his chin were dyed. His yellowish full complement of teeth displayed when he laughed were a cheap artificial set. And his hands with signet rings on both index fingers were those of an old man. With spasm of distaste, Aschenbach watched him as he kept company with his young friends. Did they not notice that he had no right to be wearing foppish and garish clothes like theirs, no right to be acting as if he were one of them? This characterization kind of loops back through in the book, and at the end, the description is actually kind of reapplied, but in turn to Aschenbach, as he has kind of gone through a similar transformation as this quest for youth. But I kind of wondered if maybe this description is actually a kind of personification of Venice, the aged city trying to look youthful, that maybe the Biennale is kind of part of these garish clothes that the city wears to remain youthful. What could be more modern than contemporary art? And in this image with Jim Lambie in the Palazzo Giustini Loeline at the Biennale in 2003. This was the first year that Scotland had a presence in Venice. Previously, there had been there still is a British pavilion, but in 2003, as a sort of part of their newfound eloquence in the wider cultural world, Scotland decided that it needed its own presence and put on this exhibition, which included the work of Jim Lambie, Claire Barclay and Simon Starling, and cited it in this palazzo, which kind of had a number of immediate difficulties in as much as they weren't allowed to put anything on the walls. And it just seems to me that if anything's going to be foppish and garish, then you might as well get it as foppish and garish as Jim Lambie. So the sort of the history of Venice is as Venice Biennale is quite a long one. It was initially formed through a city council in 1895, which is actually contemporaneous with that the book Death in Venice. There's a point in which Aschenbach is walking through the Giardini, and he talks of the new art exhibition there. So it was formed in 1895, and then in 1907 was when the first nation built its pavilion, which was Belgium, in the Giardini, which is public gardens within the city. And then between 1909 and 1914, Hungary, Germany, Great Britain, France, and Russia all added their own pavilions. As I was saying, that the with Jim Lambie and Claire Barclay and Simon Starling, this beginning of the Scottish presence, where before Scotland was a part of the British Pavilion, there now kind of evolves this strange relationship of whether or not a Scottish artist could represent Britain, since they have this their own status. And so with this kind of burgeoning community or enclave, it kind of feels both like a little village colony, but also a colonisation of Venice. There's a sense of almost like the Olympic Games or something. There's kind of supposed to be these feelings of goodwill and solidarity, but of course there's also these very strong aspects of national pride and bravado. So there's a number of different pavilions. This is the Nordic Pavilion, which was designed by Sverre Fenn, who's a great Norwegian architect. This was built in 62. He died last month, but this is kind of one of the kind of very strong culturally identifiable ones. Not only does it has that sleek, austere minimalism so much favoured in the Nordic countries, but it's literally, as you can see, built around trees. There's trees growing out of the floor. And then you kind of have other approximations of nationhood in architectural form, such as this, the German Pavilion, which feels very Spears-like. But I'm not suggesting within this that Texas needs to go down the route of building its own pavilion, although maybe the idea could be kind of nice. I'm not sure what that would be. I remember in Houston there was a rather fabulous house that somebody had built out of beer cans, which may be opposite. Both the Giardini is becoming kind of heavily populated, and there's maybe little space for anyone to cut out a little corner of that public park. So instead, there's maybe greater opportunity to return to the city itself, and in the kind of vein of the Scottish Pavilion, of appropriate or take over an existing building. And this is something that's been happening quite extensively within Venice, particularly over the last few years. A number of countries which maybe previously didn't have the resources, the inclination, or maybe the countries didn't exist, have now decided to set up their own presence within Venice. And these spaces seem to have a slightly more anachronistic or irreverent feeling to them. But it's in these moments that you can really feel that both within the Giardinian but and also in other exhibitions around the city, you can really feel the role of politics and the role of art functioning as a commodity of cultural capital within the exhibition. A recent example of which could be this, I suppose. This is from the Ukrainian pavilion. The exhibition was curated by the Ukrainian curator Peter Doroshenko, who's also the curator at the who was a curator at the Baltic and in Newcastle. And the exhibition was titled Poem of an Inland Sea and featured the work of seven artists: Sergei Batkov, Alexander Glisgenki, Lysea Zajets, Morish Mikhailov. Then you have Jürgen Teller, Mark Titchener, Sam Taylor Wood, Design. As you can tell, the latter four are not Ukrainian. And this is maybe not quite a trend, but certainly an aspect of the way in which biennales function, that you needn't belong to the country, that you can represent them in some other way. And so this piece is by Mark Titchener, who's an English artist working in London, and it was displayed as a large banner within their space. He worked in collaboration with the Revolutionary Experimental Space, which is a group of young artists from Kiev. The slogan, "We are Ukrainians, what else matters," caused a little bit of disquiet amongst the Ukrainian organizing committee. It seemed that they were kind of wanting to be, that disquiet was wanting to be manufactured as the REP group, or kind of specifically anti the institutional approach to art. And so the bringing in Titchener kind of sets him up as this invited but kind of ultimately inert sort of agent provocateur, where he was able to sort of enliven a determined forum of political dissent. Other things that within the same exhibition included the American artist Design, who pimped a Vaporetto, which is the water taxis that are so ubiquitous with Venice. And the I think within this, I think what the sort of sense that the Ukrainian pavilion was giving out was just what a open-minded and committed to avant-garde art as any other country, which then brought me on to think about another pavilion, and this one is maybe less contentious, in as much as this is the Manchester Pavilion, Manchester, the city in north of England. They realised that that especially during opening week at Venice, that the city is just awash with artists, art professionals, curators, administrators, funding agencies. You can't move in the city without bumping into these people. And so they sought to create a little solace from that incessant art world. And they approached the bar Osteria da Codroma in Venice and asked them if they could change the name of their bar to the Manchester Pavilion. The Manchester Pavilion existed at Venice in 2003 and 2005, and it kind of became the site of, I guess, another kind of form of kind of quiet rebellion within the art world professionals. It was the place you kind of went to when you didn't want to go to the Bloomberg party. And there was talk of getting a big oil drum out front where people could burn their invitations to the different parties. At the time, you know, not so much now, but certainly at the time, those invitations kind of had a sort of Willy Wonka golden ticket sort of feel to them, that people became so fanatic about getting there, but then once you kind of did end up at the party, inevitably failed to live up to the expectations. The pavilion was organised by a number of artists from Manchester, one of whom, Pavel Buchler, who describes himself as the last man standing from the Manchester Pavilion, and as much as he's the only one still in Manchester, his practice, he said, is making nothing happen. His work is kind of invariable about nothing really taking place, but an exposing of the fundamental ridiculous nature of the world around us. And so the essential tenets for the Manchester Pavilion was that it was fully licensed, open late, which was also something of a rarity in Venice at the time, and there would be no art inside to see. And I think also that this kind of approach to making the Manchester Pavilion was also about maybe poking fun at the trend within art made within the sort of representational aesthetics mode of where the art gallery would become a site for social meetings, you know, so where the art gallery is a place where they cook a meal and all, and people are supposed to come and you know, meet and talk. And this kind of idea that somehow people were unable to do this until art came along to show them that they could come and get together. And which is also a trend that I thought of becoming more evident within institutions in a kind of more formalised way. Sao Paulo Biennale this year, through a process of both curatorial zeal but also fundamentally because they were running out of money, they decided to leave the second floor of the exhibition venue completely vacant. There wasn't going to be any work in there at all. The curators described this floor, it's in a Oscar Niemeyer building in San Paolo, as the void, and wrote about it such, it would be completely open, revealing its structure and offering visitors a physical experience of the building's architecture. It is in this supposedly void territory that intuition and reason will find fertile soil to highlight the powers of imagination and invention. This is the space in which everything exists in a full and active process of becoming, thus creating the demand and the conditions for the search for other senses and new contents. I guess maybe the lure of these pristine white walls was too much for a group of São Paulo graffiti writers. They made it quite known that they were planning on doing this. I think they even sent a letter or probably an email to the director. And shortly after the exhibition opened, they kind of enacted their own process of becoming and spray painted over the walls. The 40 of them, most of whom managed to escape, a couple, as you see here, being apprehended, were said to be protesting the commercialization of graffiti within Brazilian galleries. But it kind of also points to the way in which these sort of curatorial strategies are directly provocative to opening up spaces for new discourse and allowing people to do things, but there's certainly an obvious certain extent to what you're actually allowed to do in these spaces. And I think this brings up the point that São Paulo is probably the world's second Biennale after Venice, and it's different in form as much as it's not a Biennale of national pavilions, but it's more in the mould of the kind of profusion of other Biennales that are springing up around the world. There's Biennales in Vancouver, Reykjavik, Moscow, Guangzhou, Istanbul, for example. And these are more in the mould of being curated shows, usually by a big-name curator who comes in, has a kind of loose theme, and fills up the galleries. The Biennale then serves as an engine of cultural capital itself. It's supposed to be driving tourists to these cities, again, kind of setting up the city and the country as being a purveyor and a supporter of the most modern, which then kind of brings us back to the Venice Biennale, although this is in Istanbul. The Manchester Pavilion got a number of invitations to have Manchester Pavilions at other Biennales, which they couldn't quite make sense of, and so at the Istanbul Biennale, instead of a Manchester Pavilion, they renamed a bar the Venice Biennale. So I guess the question is, why should, within this kind of strange makeup of art exhibitions, biennales and cultural capital, why should Texas have its own pavilion? I was reminded recently that the popular bumper sticker in Texas wasn't born in Texas. However, I got here as fast as I could. It seems that Texas has for a long time and continues to have a strong sense of cultural identity. In many ways, it seems that Texas is maybe more an identifiable cultural unit than America, with its disparate parts of the land and attitudes. But there seems to be a something to Texas. And I guess I have a great deal of sympathy with this statement, as I don't know if I got here as fast as I could, but I did come here, went away and came back, so that must say something of the lure of the place, the lure of the West, isn't it? And before I even came to Texas, I certainly had an idea of what Texas was, or what I thought Texas was. And I'm sure everyone has the same experience of when you say where you stay, then I know Texas people will immediately either trot out a number of stereotypes or commiserate you on having the near neighbour in the George W. Bush, or, you know, there's something that people can point to and say what it is Texas. And so this has kind of also had an effect within artists who come to Texas. This is Jonathan Mees and Peter Doig. And maybe Peter Doig is, I'm not sure how he'd describe himself now. He was born in Scotland, but he lives in Trinidad and is probably English. But coming from Scotland, I guess I kind of share this kind of sympathy or difficulty with ideas of cultural representation. Certainly, you know, when the notion of Scotland comes up, it's often in the Hollywood realm of Braveheart, you know, that somehow we all wear kilts and are running around the Highlands chasing haggis. But in the same way, maybe this kind of goes to some extent of the way in which certain artists also, when coming to Texas, play up on those stereotypes. And I guess that maybe that's the thing, that when you are part of that culture, you feel a certain comfort in yourself in mocking its own stereotypes, but somehow it can kind of grate when you see someone else doing it. So this was a performance that Peter and Jonathan did at the Ballroom in Marfa in 2006. I didn't see this, but from the reports and images that I've picked up on, there does seem to be a real preoccupation with the base idea of what Texas is to the Western world. It's kind of redolent with the, as you can see, with the Western imagery, updated with the Lone Star beers, and certainly in the vein of Jonathan's work, a strong sense of Nazi sadomasochism, I suppose it could be. But of course, this was done in Marfa, which, although it's the fitting location for many a cowboy epic, having Giant been filmed there, and the landscape lending itself so wondrously to those huge vistas, it's also the place that drew in Donald Judd. This is the Chinati Foundation, where Judd's work is. And in itself, it becomes this shifting and the way in which those boxes kind of disappear into the landscape there is maybe a kind of direct opposition to the way in which the art world has kind of imposed itself on Marfa. It's sometimes feels as achingly hip as a suburb of New York, maybe like going to Williamsburg or something. There's a huge number of attitudinal haircuts, and you can get coffees with any number of adjectives, and so you know. So we, Mies and Doig, it's not just the backdrop of Giant and cowboy and Western films, cowboy and Indian films, but it is the backdrop of Judd and the art world, and the way in which the art world has the ability to consume and repackage and make the most avant-garde safe. Now, this is an alternative use for Judd sculptures. So now I've started to look at some work from around the world, I think, that looks to Texas and looks to those stereotypes in Texas. Now, I'm not bringing these up as the idea of what would go in the Venice pavilion, although maybe some of them would be good, but rather that the way in which there is already this cultural traction within the idea of Texas that kind of makes the Venice possibility even more enticing and viable in my eyes. So this is the Richard Patterson painting, Exile on Jackson Street, which was done in 2003. This work is currently up on the Goss Michael Foundation in Dallas, where Richard has a solo exhibition, and anyone who's not seen it, I think, should go and see it very quickly. It's quite a remarkable show. Richard is an English artist. He lives in Dallas and has done for a number of years. However, this painting was made in New York when he lived there. And in talking about this painting, he says that he was thinking, it was in 2003, he was thinking about the way in which Bush's foreign policy was generating a, an image of Texas to the outside world that was becoming something different. And the painting itself is complex, if not complicated. It's a photorealist painting of this cheerleader with these gestural marks on it, but those gestural marks are actually painted on in a photorealist way. Those are not just smears. So it's really about this. It really has the sense of this layering of representation, of where representation exists within the work. This kind of idea of Texas as being a trope within popular culture kind of reaches its peak, I suppose, in my eyes, with this installation by the American artist Sean Snyder. This work is called Dallas South Fork in Hermes Land, Slobovia, Romania. This is from 2002. The work is a documentation of three South Fork ranches. The South Fork that occurs within the television series Dallas. The South Fork Ranch that exists to the east of us, out beside the city of Dallas. And the third, and possibly the most perplexing, is the South Fork Ranch that was built in Romania. During Ceausescu's regime in Romania, Ceausescu was a great fan of the Dallas, the TV show, but he also realised the cultural worth of the television programme and insisted on being broadcast throughout the country to warn the Romanian population of the evils of capitalism, make them glad that they were being squeezed tight with the communist ideals and that they weren't going to end up like Sue Ellen, I suppose. Sometime around the mid-1990s, a Romanian billionaire, Leel Alexandru, who was a huge fan of the TV show, set about to recreate his own version of the building in the Romanian hills just outside of Bucharest. He scoured the TV show, accumulating data on the building. Got a number of books and had plans drawn up. He realised, though, that although the television show showed a building that was capable of housing a number of families living in a kind of happy commune, he knew that the version in east of Dallas was incapable of doing that. So he scaled the building up 20%. The resulting building then served as his home. Larry Hagman came and visited him on one occasion and complimented him on making such a fine replica, and also that he had increased the size of it. And there's also a reported rumour that George W. Bush also visited the South Fork Ranch to attend Leel Alexandru's wedding there. This is a screenshot from one of the videos in the installation. Larry Hagman here claiming the helping hand in bringing down the Russian Empire, which he based on not the building in Romania, but that during the time of Dallas being aired that there was a great number of tapes smuggled into Russia. And so rather it had the direct effect from what Ceausescu was hoping for the Romanian people, that the Russian people actually seeing JR's mercenary tactics actually made them want a bit of the action themselves. So maybe that's what's playing out right now. Maybe you shouldn't be taking so much credit for it. So what I'm saying here is I'm not specifically, as I would say, I'm not specifically advocating that any of this work should appear within the Texas Pavilion, but rather that it gives us a kind of starting point to think about what Texas Pavilion could be. I like the fact that Texas has a cultural identity, and that it is something that is embraced by the state's inhabitants, that it is something that is propagated and advocated in the same way in which the sort of spirit of freedom and freedom of expression and freedom of ideas can make these different cultural moments come in and out of focus. And so these kind of things I've seen are kind of have a more kind of direct anthropological kind of strain running through them, but I think if a Venice Pavilion could happen, well, certainly Venice kind of doesn't need any more art. So if a Venice Pavilion could happen, what would be the most important thing for it is that it was the best art that there could be. And I don't feel uncomfortable with the idea that some of it would maybe be made by non-Texans. Sometimes there's a good point of seeing yourself how others see you, as Robert Burns put it. So anyway, this is maybe my closing shot. Maybe this is what we could have in 2011. And as I said at the beginning, this talk, I wanted to give it in the vein of eliciting some kind of response and a form of public consultation, because I would like to try and make this happen. So any comments and thoughts at this point would be gratefully received. Okay, no, maybe not.
I have a question. Like when you're thinking about this,